Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month we present a story from our current issue, July-August 2023. It's by Pat Black, a Scottish journalist and author who currently lives in Yorkshire, England, but says that he'll always belong to his native Glasgow. It's in Glasgow that the series of stories he's been contributing to EQMM since 2019 is set. This series, starring central characters Detective Inspector Lohman and Detective Sergeant Slater, can always be relied upon to deliver something unusual and unexpected. This story is no exception. Here is Pat Black reading his story, Two's on That.
The old man rolled his drip along the uneven pavement. One of the four wheels refused to behave itself, catching, snagging, twisting, sometimes stopping altogether, and he cursed it. "Shot 'em, trolley," the old man barked. "A closing down sale. Everything must go. Ha!" Then he coughed. It was a short trip from the side entrance of the infirmary to the unofficial smoker's shed, but the old man struggled nonetheless. His grandson, Keith, moved to help him, reaching out to the drip's vertical steel frame, but without much conviction. He knew the kind of terse response any intervention would receive. "Leave it," the old man duly replied. "If I can't roll this pile of junk along the pavement, you might as well kill me now." Keith made no reply. He kept in step with the old man's slipper-clad shuffle towards the smoking shed, the scene of the final indignity. The squat fiberglass shelter had once been on hospital premises. Changing rules meant it now bided a few yards out of bounds, keeping a respectful distance. There was only one person inside the shed as the two men approached, a porter who Keith recognised. This man had a young old face, with curly hair grown somewhat unruly that must have been riotous when he was young, on top of sharp features, thin, maybe too angular to be called handsome. The porter found a space to stub out his cigarette in an ashtray overflowing with tarry filters, like maggots seething from a burst bin bag. "Going already?" the old man asked, as the porter quick marched back into the hospital. "No rest for the wicked, Jack," the porter said over his shoulder. "Catch you later." The old man looked disappointed as the porter departed. Keith watched him fumble in his dressing gown for his pack. "Other pocket," Keith said. "Yeah, I know," the old man snapped. Wizened and wiry were terms that might have been used about Jack McLinden in normal circumstances. He had never had any fat on his frame, and before the disaster, he had liked to boast about this. Miraculously, some hair had just about remained after the treatment had begun, although it was sparse and grey, apt to blow in the wind. Clothes were a mockery on a frame where even hard angles had begun to disappear. Even his medium mint-green pyjamas waved merrily in the wind, threatening to abscond with a particularly stiff breeze. Sometimes it was hard to discern a body in there at all. The old man might have been a joke, a comic photocopy placed on top of a coat hanger. The cord of his new dressing gown never seemed to stay tied for long either, trailing along Jack's feet like a broken tail, its ends already brittle with dirt. Completing the picture was the drip, attached to his matchstick wrists, the display counting down how long his latest dose had to go. And then, of course, came the cigarette. Jack's technique had been honed over a lifetime. The filtered cigarette placed between the lips, the quick draw flick, spark and draw. The bright flares as he inhaled, hard. The tip of the cigarette briefly laced with meandering red filigree, briefly beautiful. "Don't look at me like that," Jack said, exhaling through his nose. "Like what?" "Like that, down your nose, sneering at me." Keith found it much easier to keep his mouth shut with the old man in a vulnerable state, and he did so now. Jack went on, "Yeah, I know, guy with cancer smokes, headline news. I've heard it all before, kid. Your dad tried that one on me, and I tell him where to go. Flounced off in a huff. I know when he put it past you to flap your gums either, so don't bother trying." "Didn't say anything." "Didn't need to say anything. It was all in your look. I slapped it off your dad's face 1,000 times. "Yeah, he told me about that." Jack laughed and scratched his chin. "You might do all right, son. You just might. You've got moxie. That's a word I learned." His stubbly skin not only sounded like sandpaper, it looked like it too. Pallor was the common shorthand for sickness, but Jack's skin was not pallid. It had festered rather than faded. There was colour, but it was crude and uncomely, a gaudy yet impoverished tone. Surely nothing could conquer that yellow cast. There was no mixture on the palate that could improve it, except for one. I hope you're feeling all right, Grander. The old man laughed in the middle of a draw, then coughed horrendously. His pipe cleaner frame sagged alarmingly for a moment, and Keith started forward. "Nah, I'm fine," Jack wheezed, "in a manner of speaking. This stuff knocks you sick. They say it'll keep me going for an extra 6 months. Wow, wee, I might see the full winter, but pushing up the daisies in the springtime." "Ugh," was all Keith could say. Jack sucked on that cigarette with resilience, stoicism. He squared what was left of his chin and gazed somewhere over Keith's shoulder. If Keith hadn't seen the pictures of Jack in the early 1960s, in his perfectly cut dark suit and his black hair brill-creamed to an extraordinary vinyl sheen, he might never have known that this wreck was once a handsome and popular man. "Anyway, about time you were going, eh? Someone tells me you get a wee bird on the go." Keith shrugged. "Maybe." "Ha! I know how it goes, wee man. Don't you worry about that. I'm not long for it, but I've lived. Have no doubt. Get yourself going. Fair play to you for putting her down for 5 minutes. Had it been me, I wouldn't have bothered coming here. You've proved me wrong all the same. Didn't think you were into that." "Into what?" "You know, lassies." "I'll wait here until you're done." "Chemo will be ticking over past visiting time. I meant your cigarette." "Want one?" Jack grinned. "We can go twos on this one. Never too late to start, young man. You look like you could do it. Keeps your jaw lying sharp." "That's the worst thing you've ever said. Seriously." "Go on, beat it," the old man jerked his head. "You're only here to mark time. Holiday of obligation, is it? Forget about me. Forget all about this. Enjoy your night. Give the young lady a big kiss for me." "I'll see you later, Grander," Keith said, a note of contempt creeping into his voice after all. The younger man hitched his backpack on his shoulder and crossed the road into the slipstream around the back of the hospital building, a place where they kept the guts of the place hidden, twists of stark aluminium piping spewing steam and other unspeakable emissions rising from the furnace. He had gone maybe 40 yards before he heard the explosion. Charlie Minchin had shaved off his moustache. This event was cause for great hilarity. Someone in the team had marked the occasion with a cake, iced with the message, "R.I.P. the 80s, underneath a huge sugar candy mauser. But Detective Inspector Lomond had to concede that there was something unsettling about this change in the pathologist. It was like Wellington without his traffic cone helmet on Queen Street. Secretly, everyone missed the moustache, including Minchin's upper lip, which appeared to have packed up and left after its partner, perhaps in mourning. One thing you can say, he didn't feel a thing. The pathologist gestured towards the body on the slab beyond the window. Given how he was going out, you could say he got a fair deal. "Cancer patient," Lomond said. "Yep. I can tell by the colour of the skin." Riddled with it turned out. Started in his lungs, spread its fingers out from there. Surprised they got another dose of chemo. Would have been useless, same with the radiotherapy after that. Already in his bones. Probably his brain too. Though no one could say for sure now. You don't really need the cause of death, do you? Lomond did not. He still did not know what Jack McLinden's face had looked like. It, and most of the head surrounding it, had been obliterated, spread all over the smoker's shelter and the scuffed pavement alongside it. Through some freak deflection, the trolley containing it, his drip, had somehow remained standing after the explosion, as if anchoring the body to the spot. A scorched remnant of what remained of Jack's throat was angled towards the two men, a sickly flower on the tongue. "What's the score, Lomi?" Minchin asked. "Anyone get back to you and what was used yet?" "It's not a gunshot, I can say that. I've seen people with those, self-inflicted or otherwise." The folk from the army in counter-terror aren't 100% sure on the details, but off the record, it was a bomb. Minchin snorted in surprise. "A bomb? It'd have blown the lot of them to pieces, surely. In pieces of pieces. Arms and legs. Disarticulated. Knickers off. I've seen bombs before. Loman shook his head. A very clever bomb. I won't call it smart, but you get the idea. Just enough of an explosive, a tiny, tiny amount. How did he manage to get a bomb in his mouth? Minchin was incredulous. Did a spider throw a wee grenade? Kamikaze fly with a bit of TNT strapped to its leg? Loman had a way of denying laughter to sick jokes that people didn't take offence to. A certain softness in his demeanour and his posture. A deft physical way of not giving offence or projecting unease. Looks like it was in the cigarette he was smoking. Seriously? Deadly. And the tip? I wouldn't have done that to his head. Looks like it was in the filter. Once the cigarette burned down a certain distance, it triggered a fuse, then the explosive. Take it he wasn't any kind of target? No. Ordinary working man, coming to the end of his time. No enemies to speak of, no record, no politics. Didn't even like a football. Looks random. Christ, that's going to give you a problem, Lomi. It's going to give everyone a problem. Absolutely right. You got a pack on you, chick? Well, aye. Minchin patted his pockets for his usual 20 pack, probably lay. Not for long. You didn't often see Chick Minchin astonished, the inspector thought. You calling him in, Lomi? Cigarettes? All of them? Can you do that? Watch your news. Loman took one last look at the headless man on the slab before leaving. Two girls, one guy. Two wanted, one not. He'd watched them, frankly, from the far corner of the alleyway, which the pub had breezily advertised in blue neon as the smoker's paradise. Apart from two rotting wooden tables and a parasol base that had undergone a sudden divorce from its canopy during high winds, there was nothing to suggest basic comfort, let alone paradise. All the same, Sarah and Millie had got to talking out there, preferring this arrangement to the louder group they'd left inside the pub. Sarah had noticed them first. She spoke as she exhaled a cloud of peach-infused smoke. Don't look now, we've got an admirer, Ted Bundy. Millie looked over her shoulder. You're joking. Ted Bundy had a full head of hair and surface appeal. The man watching them had a receding hairline which he had shaved into the quick and chubby cheeks that almost threw you off the fact that he was well in his 40s. Seeing himself noticed, he ambled over to Sarah and Millie. Hey, heard a cracking joke, he said. Want to hear it? Not particularly, Sarah said. Ah, you'll love it. Two cigarettes are walking down the street. Mummy cigarette and a baby cigarette. See the end of a smoke lying in an alley. Baby says, Mummy, what happened to that cigarette? And the mummy cigarette says, he had an unfortunate life. Baby says, but how did they end up in there and we're out here? Mummy says, it's just the luck of the draw, son. The man stamped on the ground and curtsied. Sarah and Millie didn't make a sound. No? The newcomer cocked his head. Not into that one. Never mind. I'm Max, by the way. How you doing? Still no talking? Never mind. I've got another one. Big chimney and little chimney are on the top of the flats. Big chimney says to the little chimney, you're too young to smoke, Sarah said. That one's as old as smoking itself. Oh, you've got me, girls. I don't write my own material, I admit it. He sat down beside Millie, opposite Sarah. Millie was the shorter of the two, with natural blonde hair cut short. She had a doleful look about her, but this was not a match for her personality, as Max found out. Listen, mate, this is a private conversation, she said, looking him in the eye. Understood, appreciated, and granted. I just wanted to offer you a smoke. We've got some. Millie raised her e-cigarette, its blue light tracing a high arc in the air. Ah, that's not a smoke though, is it? You both got one, I see. You buy those today? Maybe we did, Sarah said. Taller and darker, with shoulder-length black hair, she was more amused by Max's intrusion than her companion. Maybe we like it. You've bought it because of what happened up at the hospital. And what the police said at the press conference, he scoffed. What a nonsense, that. It's not nonsense for that poor man, is it? Millie asked. I'll tell you a story about that. I heard that the old guy was taken out by a sniper.
It was a hit. He had gangland connections. All this. Max gestured into the air while the woman's peach vapes garlanded his head. It's a cover story. Sounds exciting, Sarah said. You're saying they're pulping the city's entire stock of cigarettes because they wanted to cover up an old man getting shot. That's what I heard, Max said. And they didn't want anyone to know he was shot by a sniper because, Millie asked. So that nobody would panic, Max said, unabashed. And instead, telling people that their heads might get blown off any second through taking a smoke, that's not causing a panic, he grinned. I'm just telling you what I heard. I don't think you thought it through, Millie said sadly. Shame. Eh, you got me. I did say I don't write my own material. Then Max grew serious. What I am serious about, though, is an offer I have to make. Millie rolled her eyes and turned away from him. And although Sarah laughed, her patience was up. Oh, spare us, pal. Eh, we're just having a chat here. You're interrupting. It's an offer of cigarettes. I get them from a guy I know. Max pulled out a pack from his pocket. Excuse me, Millie said, raising a hand. You have read the news. You were paying attention to what we said a minute ago. These are the smokes out of a regular shop, Max said. I know a guy who gets them for me out of wholesale. He can have one. They're legit, absolutely spot on. He opened the pack, where two rows of 10-tip cigarettes emerged. His eyes quickened, moving between Sarah and Millie. And yes, that had found its mark. They both gazed at the open pack. Sarah even licked her lips. No tricks, Max said. You can have one. You can have a few packs. No problem. And how much do you want for these special packs? Sarah asked. Well, usually I'd name a price, but... Come out with me for a drink tomorrow night, and you can have this pack for nothing. Though he hadn't been asking her, Millie pointed at him. Now, I must admit, that's a decent hustle. He's not had long to practice this. He's good, I have to say. Max ignored Millie. What's your answer? He asked Sarah. Tempting as those are, you heard the police. We're good with vapes for now. She got up from her seat, and Millie joined her. Yeah, nice try all the same, Millie said. She blew smoke at him. Max placed a cigarette between his lips. Just before you go, he said, his voice crumpled in his clamped jaws like a ventriloquist's. There were these two matches, right, walking down the road. One says to the other, save it, Millie said. Some other time, Sarah said, less severely. Ah, there's a smile. Maybe I'll see you here tomorrow. Anyway, he struck the match and put it to the cigarette. Back to the two matches. Big one says to the other, hey, your head's on fire. And the little one says, a crack rather than a blast is how Sarah described it to Lomond about 30 minutes later. She was the only one to see it, although both of them ended up covered in Max's blood. Two girls, no man. When Lomond was agitated, his hands were a giveaway. In this instance, he struggled to remove the cellophane wrapping around his cheese and chilli jam sandwiches. Like finding the end of the sticky tape, Lomond grimaced. Detective Sergeant Slater chose an oblique line of attack. Don't know how you can stand these soggy sandwiches. You can't breathe under the cling film. It's murder. Normally I wouldn't bother, Lomond said, finally uncovering enough of the bread to fit between his teeth. But my other half made them for me. They were sat on a bench by the Clydeside, close to the water, with the Kingston Bridge thundering overhead on their 5 minute break. This was something they both referred to as going for fresh air, with no discernible irony. Slater sipped a coffee from the kiosk on the waterfront, which served the insurance firms and government buildings by the converted quayside, and he said, so, how'd the press conference go? Lomond looked up sharply, twin points of light gleaming in his small, dark eyes. You mean you didn't see it? May have seen something. My daughter got in touch. Said something about a collar sticking out from under my jumper. Said she'd seen it online. Slater said. He tried to keep his voice neutral, but lost the fight.
spluttering through a mouthful of instant. "What is it, woman?" sighed. "Get it over with, Malcolm." Slater produced his phone. "Well, gaffer, you know what folk are like on the internet now. Few people commented on your collar sticking out of the neckline of your pullover. Well," he opened a window and showed the inspector the screen. Loman took a deep breath as he scrolled through the endless memes, his face pinched tight under the glare of the press conference lights. There he was, mocked up as a mad professor, or a tramp, or with Dracula's cape doubling for the dog-eared white shirt collar tip that poked up towards his grey stubbled chin. And finally there he was, with Columbo's Mac pasted in on top of his pullover. This is when he's finally laughed. "Bastards," he said agreeably, handing back the phone. "I'm guessing I'll be hearing about this back at the station. Bet the house on it, gaffer. Anyway, I was just thinking, if we were smokers, we'd probably be out here having a break." Loman bit his sandwich in half. "Yep," he said, chewing. "But thank God, I never started." "Me either. Know what put me off? The bleep test." "What's that when it's at home?" "You never get the bleep test at school. You must have done it at Tully Allen. You're not that old, surely." "Rings a bell." "Yeah, we get the bleep test in training, I think, but not at school. What does that have to do with smoking?" "A few of my mates started smoking. At school, like. We were 13, 14. I was thinking about it. I even pretended to smoke one, you know, trying to talk to lassies in the smoker's shed. Anyway, I noticed a few of the boys that smoked dropped out of the bleep test when they were running. A few of them started coughing. Fit guys as well, or they had been. Football players. Saw them coughing and wheezing and I thought, that's not for me." "It's just disgusting," the inspector said with unusual candour. "When I was a kid, my mum and dad smoked. Imagine the house filled with blue smoke. Even when they weren't around, the smoke was. It's like you couldn't disperse it. A fresh coat of white paint was put down in the house. You realised how yellow everything got. Diabolical. It did fill them eventually. Lung cancer. Both of them. And two of my grandparents before them. COPD. Tumour in the tongue. You see it happen to someone once, that's enough. Any more than that." Loman finished his sandwich, rolled up the cellophane into a tight little ball and dropped it into his overcoat pocket. "Shouldn't admit this, but I bear a grudge." Slater finished his coffee. "Think our culprit feels the same?" "Good chance yet. I think there's only one thing we can be sure of. He isn't a smoker." "I think every smoker in the country bears a grudge against you now, gaffer. Now that they've made you our public face. Imagine it. Folk having to hand over their smokes. People will be getting out of their minds. Someone said Chick Minchin was literally trying to bite people at the canteen. Covered himself with nicotine patches. Looks like the mummy, they said. We probably pushed the murder rate up in this country, confiscating every single smoke. Giving ourselves more work. There's a time for keeping the head down and a time for pushing the button." Loman got to his feet. "Anyway, this is a working lunch. Jack McClendon's grandson is on the way. When did you set this up?" "Just before I went on stage. I'm not just in this business to look good, Malcolm." Loman thought of him as a boy, even though he was nearly 30. Keith McClendon dressed young, putting Loman in mind of the skateboarders and rollerblade boys his daughter had been smitten with in her early teenage years. He slouched when he walked down the waterside towards them, a backpack perched over one shoulder. It slid off continually, and the boy was forever hitching it up. Loman had to restrain an urge to tell him to adjust the bloody strap. Considering what he'd experienced a couple of days before, he looked fairly relaxed, although he seemed to take fright when Slater asked him, "What is it you do?"
"Do?"
Keith McClendon blinked. "Aye, as in, what's your occupation?"
"I'm a student, information technology, Stowe College."
I was about to ask, "Where are you studying?" But sometimes that offends people. Making an assumption, you know. McClendon considered Slater as if trying to decode something said to him in high school French. Then he turned to Lomond. "Have you been able to find anything else out?"
"Nothing concrete just yet," the inspector said. "I was hoping I could find out something from you, though."
McClendon shrugged. His backpack slipped with the movement, and he hauled it back over his shoulder.
Go ahead.
Did your granda have any mates in the ward, anyone he knew? Keith glanced at the water, slate blue in the cool autumn day.
Not sure. He seemed to know the porter, just to talk to.
The guy at the shelter?
Aye, I think he was a porter anyway. Said hello to him, had a bit of a chit-chat.
My granda wasn't really the chatty type, you know. He wouldn't just say hello to anyone.
Loman made a note, then underlined it.
How are you bearing up, son?
Me?
McClendon faltered for a moment, licked his lips, swallowed.
Okay, thanks. No one's asked me that, really. Apart from the police at the hospital.
My dad isn't so good.
He shrugged.
Loman paused. The boy had only seen the aftermath. That word again, boy. But boy fit all right. But so had Loman, and it was bad enough.
Thanks for coming to see us, Keith. You've been a big help. And I just want to say, those numbers on the leaflet our team will have given you, give them a call. They're there to help any time you need it. Don't be alone. Don't suffer. There's nothing good in suffering. That's one thing I know. Okay?
The boy nodded, then waved at them, not wanting to use his voice for fear of it fracturing.
Slater watched them go.
Sorry, Gaffer. Thought I was putting them at ease. It just made it more awkward. Suppose there's no putting people at ease after something like that.
You get a million people, you get a million reactions.
What's your thinking in the hospital, Gaffer? That's what you're interested in, eh?
Just a wee idea. We know the first explosion was at the hospital, or just outside it. The second one was at the pub, two blocks down from the smoker's shed. Called the Doctor's Rest, would you believe?
I know that pub. It's close, but not exactly on hospital doorstep, is it?
Closest we've got to a link. Let's go for it. I want to speak to this porter for myself.
Just as well I grabbed a coffee earlier, Slater muttered.
You're looking well for it all the same, Malcolm. Slater's brow furrowed in an instant suspicion.
I'm flattered. Thanks very much.
What do you want?
Fancy doing the next press conference for me?
What? Slater cried, genuine alarm.
You're a natural. You'd be great at it, Loman said,
a grin threatening to escape from his clenched jaw. They were sat in the hospital refectory. TV was tuned to the news, and everyone in there watched it. They didn't realise that the detective who'd appeared briefly on a soundbite, with his collar sticking up at a comic angle, sat among them, his words scrolling past in yellow and black on the chiron.
National news, Gaffer Slater said, drumming his fingers on the canteen tabletop.
International, in fact. Headlines all over the world. Stock markets, global panic. You haven't been such a public menace since your dancing days.
You've nothing to worry about when you do your piece to camera, Loman said soothingly. Just take a deep breath and think of the watching millions.
Slater muttered something under his breath, then checked his watch.
Hope this guy hasn't stood us up.
Maybe he's having a smoke, Loman ventured.
When he finally arrived, the porter wasn't smoking, but looked as if he wanted to. He picked at the skin, bedding his fingernails as he spoke.
I remember him all right, the porter said. He'd been in a few times for his chemo. His name was Jack. Bit of a character. Thought it was a big wheeze smoking during his treatment.
Spoke to his grandson earlier today, Loman said, flipping over a page in his notebook. He said Jack McLendon wasn't really the chatty type.
Different in the smoker's shed, eh? Kind of like a confessional. You get an excuse to talk to people.
The social side of a bad habit.
The porter, whose name is Alexander Norris, but called himself Xander, had the well-lined face of a smoker, on top of the wiry frame of a hospital porter. His hair must have been curly once, Loman thought. He remembered a boy with similar curls when he'd been at school. He also had a habit of sudden twitches or adjustments in his posture, which put the two policemen on edge.
Slater said, "Do you not find it a bit odd, being a smoker with the job you do?"
"I'm not sure I follow you there, bud."
"I mean, you just said you were talking to a man wheeling around a drip with his chemo in it, probably not long for living. You'll see more of what cancer does to people than many other folk, including the aftermath."
"I wish I didn't smoke, if that's what you're asking me," Norris answered frankly. "But we've all got something we do that could put us in the ground." You take a bevy, officer. While Slater thought up a reply, the porter turned to Lomond. And you don't look like you're a stranger to a square meal, if you don't mind my saying so. Never mind a cheek, Lomond said. I'm just saying. Heart disease, diabetes, cancer of the liver, cancer of the tongue, stomach cancer, bowel cancer, eating the wrong stuff, drinking the wrong stuff, not enough exercise. That's before we get to pollution, particulate matter. All of that can have an effect. We can't be sure what triggers what we've got in us. We time bombs. Norris realised what he'd said and his shoulders stiffened. I didn't mean... The thing about all the stuff you mentioned, Lomond said, his cheeks still red after the insult, is if I was to have a big fry up in the morning, or if D.S. Slater here was to have a pint in the evening after he finishes up, it's no odds to anyone else. If you smoke, you can be affecting the people and the environment round about you. I don't throw fried eggs about in the street, and D.S. Slater doesn't spit out every second mouthful of his drink into people's faces. Nah, but he might start a fight, or have a row with his missus when he gets home. All I'm saying is, everything we consume has an effect, and not just on us, even down to the air you breathe. And at the end of the day, something's going to take us out. Jack McLendon was taken out by an explosive in his cigarette, Lomond said. Someone put it there. You were one of the last people to see him alive. Norris sat back and folded his arms. So? I'm just wondering, did they ever tap a cigarette off you? Lomond checked his notes again, frowning. Did he ever go twos on one if he ran out? Another patient in the same ward as him said he often ran short of cigarettes or didn't have enough money. Not that I can remember, Norris said. No cigarette machines in the hospital, Slater mused. Good move that, I would say. Progressive. Norris shrugged. His mouth twitched. Lomond took a deep breath. We spoke to everyone who was on the ward with Mr. McLendon on the day. We found out a lot of interesting stuff. We found out that there's someone in the hospital with a nice little sideline. That right? Yes, Lomond continued briskly. We found out that you can actually buy cigarettes at hospital, if you know the right guy. Norris might have been sculpted from wax. Even the tremors and ticks stopped, and he folded his hands. Not just any old cigarettes either. Counterfeits. Quite convincing ones, it seems. I've checked out the packets, so detailed. Even down to trademarks, serial numbers. You'd need to know what you were looking for to know the difference. I just want to say, Norris said, I have nothing to do with it. What happened to that old guy? Nothing. Save it for the interview room, Slater said with a touch of relish. But if you really want to help, show us where you're keeping the cigarettes and tell us where you got them. Now. You look scared, Squint, Danny said. You shouldn't be. In fact, Squint had tried his absolute hardest not to look scared. But he couldn't disguise the tremor in his hands as he slid a cigarette out of the pack. There he goes, Danny clapped his hands and then took on the febrile tones of a football commentator. He takes the snout from the pack, but does Squint have the guts? That's the question the crowd are asking of this young man. Squint's nickname was the result of an unfortunate oracular condition which had been corrected 2 years before. His eyesight was now perfect, but the name had stuck. He was a bumptious lad of 11, with a squashed tumshy face which people found adorable, much to his dismay. Squint was out with Danny Gardner, who was much bigger, but was also in Squint's year at school. They also had an audience out there in the lush turf behind the red ash football pitch of St Matthew's, the other boys they played football with. The game had long stopped, having been one-sided in favour of Danny's team. Squint had been stuck in goals, with little to do bar peeling the paint off the goalposts. Now, there was a different sport to play. Squint removed the cigarette from the pack. "Don't know what you're worried about," he said, mimicking the drawl he had heard and admired on a heist movie 2 nights before. Nonetheless, Squint's hands shook as he placed the cigarette between his lips and he struggled to turn the wheel on the emerald green clipper lighter. There was a nervous titter among the other boys. "Want me to hold it for you?" Danny sneered, arms crossed across his pristine Scotland strip. Squint put the flame to the tip of the cigarette, the contact too close to his face to focus on. Almost instinctively, mimicking most of the adults in his life, he inhaled, but he held short of taking the smoke into his lungs. It scoured the top of his mouth. He wanted to cough, but suppressed it. Then he exhaled from one side of his mouth as casually as he could. "Now you," Squint said. "It's no problem," Danny said. "More chance of being hit by lightning." Here was a confident campaigner, no question of that. The cigarette was nimble in Danny's fingers. Speed denoted skill. He took the clipper from Squint and lit, inhaled, and exhaled quickly. "Bang!" Squint cried out. Danny only smiled, blowing smoke into his face. "Down to the last four cigarettes. It's like the semi-finals. Will we make it to the last two?" "This is boring." This came from James Cowan, a ferret-faced boy from another school who Squint had taken a dislike to. "There's no chance of it happening. No way." "It's a dodgy packet," Danny Gardner said archly. "One of the ones on the news. My dad had them. He said he wanted to leave them out for the collection, but he forgot." "That was mental," Squint said. "Collecting packs of ciggies from every house. All because of one nutter." "Less talk, more smoke," Danny said. "There's a good chance a dodgy pack has a big one in it. They caught 20 bombs for the packs they've seized so far. Some going." "You reckon it takes your whole heat off?" James Cowan asked. "So I heard." Danny Gardner took a drag. "Maybe it just leaves a stump or a bit of spine. Sticking out like a chicken bone. Bound to be a mess, mind you. Imagine it. 1 minute you're there enjoying a nice wee smoke. And next, Danny Gardner!" His mother, oh God, his mother, the PTA queen herself, the requester of masses for children on away trips, the singer at the very top of her voice in the front pew every Sunday, charging over the top of the verge leading to the red ash pitch, every corner and curve of her bouncing in time with her terrifying running gait, hurtling towards them, face contorted. "Put that down right now!" Danny Gardner's face went white at that point, whiter than it had been when he took the first straw. Just as skillfully as he'd lit up, he flicked his cigarette towards the pitch and folded his arms behind his back. "Get rid of the smoke, you dafty," he hissed, as Squint blinked at the cigarette in his hand. "Oh, Christ," Squint said, dropping the cigarette and crushing it underfoot. The other boys began to laugh, then, as Danny's mother closed the gap. She had slowed down from her initial sprint, and this was what saved her. At the crucial moment, she was still a good 40 yards away. The blast was sudden and brutal. A crater appeared in the pitch where the smoking cigarette had landed, belching red ash into the air. The goalposts, suddenly divested of one strut, screeched and fell with an audible metal clang, a geometry problem with a great red X marked alongside it. The boys flinched as the red ash rained down on them in clumps. They could smell the explosive, a trace memory that would haunt them for the rest of their lives. Danny's mother simply sat down on the pitch, not even blinking, as she was showered with red grit, as her son ran towards her, sobbing. The cash and carry was busy, but still had a somewhat sepulchral feel thanks to the vast roof space echoing with shouts and the sound of hydraulics as the forklift trucks moved between the racks. All manner of goods were here. There was even a suggestion that an illegal wet market operated in some dark, damp corner. But Lomond was only interested in the cigarettes. No one had seen Lomond appear at the main entrance where the vans and lorries made their pickups or deposits. It was only when the foreman, McRobbie, spotted someone not wearing high vis or a hard hat that alarms were sounded. "Oh, who are you playing at, you madman?" McRobbie bellowed. He knocked his own helmet with his fist and looked as if he meant it. "Hard hat? Now?" "Don't mind me," Lomond said, smiling. "I'm not here to pick up any material." McRobbie's face turned the blotchy crimson of an angry giant octopus, a fine contrast to the stark white of his millinery. "You what? You daft or something?" "Let's sort this out calmly," Lomond said, producing his warrant card. I believe you're in charge of this site, and that was all. Lohmann was talking to an empty space, a swirl of air molecules, rapidly expanding gases where a person once was. The hard hat and high-vis vest streaked across the shop floor, away from the gaping maw of the tall, broad entry gate, and towards a side door, which was pretty good going for Lohmann, as that's precisely where he'd predicted the site foreman would go. He barely broke into a stroll, never mind a jog, as he watched Slater appear from behind, huckling the man, dropping him in a flare of plutonium yellow. Not too much later, Lohmann sat in front of him with McRobbie, with his hands folded, restraining himself from providing a conciliatory gesture of any kind as the man sobbed like a little boy. "Any idea, I swear to it, I swear." McRobbie wiped his eyes, then his nose, with the sleeve of his overalls. "You're allowed to use a tissue," Slater said. "Box is right beside you, Chief." Lohmann waited until McRobbie had blown his nose, then asked, "What made you set fire to the cigarettes? Surely you'd been better off getting your load collected." "Didn't want them traced to me, did I? I didn't know there were any explosives in it. That's why I set fire to it out in the braes, you know, up near the woods. Nobody goes there, not even people on mountain bikes or weirdos." Matter of fact, there was a rambling society half a mile away, which is plenty close enough when that amount of plastic explosive goes off at one time. They were lucky. So were you. McRobbie's hands shook, as did his voice. "Swear to you again, in anyone's life, I don't know anything about plastic, explosive, bombs, whatever. I had a load of the knocked-off snout, I admit that. I torched them, I admit all that. But I didn't have anything to do with placing them." "We believe you," Slater said, "but we need CCTV to find out who might have been responsible, who brought the load in." "There's no CCTV here, Inspector. There's a few things goes on in that warehouse, you know. Stuff you don't want to appear on CCTV. You know, I still think a man in your position, or in your boss's position, might still want to have an eye on who comes in and who comes out and who does what. Especially if there was dodgy stuff coming in. You know, like fake cigarettes, knockoff gear, that kind of thing. You'd want to keep tabs, I would think." Lohmann grinned. "You'd know where we could access tapes from your last delivery, wouldn't you?" "I don't..." McRobbie stared from Lohmann to Slater, both of whom were smiling in a way the site foreman found gruesome. "I mean, there's no chance." "We'll seize it anyway," Slater said. "Computers, cloud content, you name it, so why not save us all some time? Wednesday, you said, the smoke came in." "That's right." "Aye. Okay. Take us to your leader, or your leader's office." "Come on, mate, we clocked the cameras when we drove into the car park. Do the right thing. And we might close our eyes to the rest of your business in there." "Right," McRobbie said. "I heard that there's a wee room, right, up the fire escape stairs, a wee office. There's usually a wee security man in there. He'll still be there." "Great, up the fire escape we go then," Lohmann said, clapping his hands. On a screen in the office, the security guard didn't say a word as he rewound the digital footage from an impressive and bewildering array of computer screens. Either just before retirement age, or in the blast zone just after it, he spent more time glancing at the doorway, fearful of someone he referred to as the Big Inn interrupting him as he entertained the two policemen. "There it is there," the guard said, pointing at the screen. "Boy called Michael, boy for Deniston, drives all over. He comes in with a load of gear that he gets off the ferry. That's the guy who brought the load in." Lohmann peered at the screen. His phone was in his hand. This was the moment, he knew. "He's just lowered the ramp at the back of the lorry for the forklift," the inspector remarked, watching the pin clear image. "You know that driver by any chance?"
"Aye, that's Daff Trevor."
"That the name on his birth certificate?" Lohmann asked.
"Eh, might be. Don't know," the security guard said tetchily.
Lohmann leaned forward. "Anyone helping with the unloading here? Does someone get paid to do that?"
"Do what?" the security guard said. "There's nobody there. I quit."
"You're right. My mistake. There is someone hovering about in the background. That's weird." "Isn't it just?" Lohmann said. He found a number on his phone and dialed in. Pause that footage a wee minute and roll it back, Slater said to the security guard. I want to see what the gaffer just saw. Yep, that's it, right there. There's somebody there for sure, the security guard said, absorbed with the problem. He just ran in there and ran back out. Can't make anything out, hardly. It's a good shot. Maybe I can screen grab it and blow it up for you. It'll be all distorted, though. Not sure there's enough detail. There's plenty of detail, woman said. Look, on the shoulder. The security guard frowned and leaned closer to the screen. What's that he's got there? He got a wee handbag or something? Yes, he does, Slater said, realisation dawning, as he watched the figure on the screen throw some packets of cigarettes into the back of the forklift, mingling with the packs loaded on top. Then the figure hitched his backpack onto his shoulder and walked away. He wasn't wearing a hard hat either, Slater noted grimly. Best to just let the heavy mob handle it, Slater said, leaning back in the passenger seat of Loman's car. Never can tell where these weirdos. Nah, Loman said, his eyes tracing the red sandstone street outside. I want to hear what he has to say. We've traced the counterfeit smokes to the cash and carry. Our man here put the sabotage smokes in that one particular load. I get that. The pack spread out for there. The porter dished them out at the hospital and run about the pubs in the immediate area. What I find hard to believe, knowing all this, is who the first victim was. It still seems like a horrible coincidence. I don't think it was a coincidence, Loman said. That's what I want to ask him about. Here he comes now. Slater peered into the green space, bisected with a path, which had been cordoned off half an hour before. An indistinct figure shuffled towards them. You sure? Definitely. He just got off that number 9 bus, and I recognised the slouch. God, that bag irritates me. Why doesn't he just tighten the strap? Keep a close watch on the backpack, Loman cautioned. Watch his hands. Don't be a hero. He reaches inside the bag. We got off our mark, and they take him out. The man they wanted ambled towards them past a row of wheelie bins belonging to the evacuated flats to the left, already emptied that day, and arranged in uneven, aesthetically irritating ranks. He adjusted the bag on his shoulder, head down, hair tossed by the wind. Loman barked an order into his radio, then got out. The man with the backpack spotted him immediately, stopped, but didn't run. Keith McClendon? Loman asked, striding towards him. McClendon let the strap slide off his shoulders and into his hand, a smooth, well-practiced movement. He dangled the bag from his fingers for a moment, as if judging the weight and how far I might throw it. Put it down, Slater screeched. Down now! There are armed police covering you, Keith. This is no joke, mate. Put the rucksack down, very slowly, very calmly. Don't do anything that makes anyone excited. If I don't, will they shoot me? He giggled, and the inspector felt fear clutch at his belly. Loman realised the boy was unhinged then, and Loman knew all about the unhinged ones. No one wants to get shot, the inspector said. Let's have no more deaths. Do what D.S. Slater tells you. You can try to put it right. You can still have a life. You can talk to us about it. Put the bag down slowly and keep your hands up where we can see them. Keith complied, raising his hands and stepping back after he placed the rucksack on the path. On either side of the residential street beyond the cordon, windows were opening. Telltale illuminations as smartphones were activated. You know, I thought I'd get more than 2 in the scorecard, McClendon said. Now he'd been exposed, his demeanour was different. All the diffidence gone, the boy no longer. You guys were good at your job, I'll say that. Got me fast enough. Look how quickly you closed the door on it. You probably damaged the industry better than I did. The whole supply chain of Europe shut down. You weren't taking any chances. Might never go back to normal, they say. All thanks to you. I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder, Loman said, and recited the rest of the catechism as McClendon grinned. Your granda, son, the inspector said finally. Your own granda. McLendon shrugged. He was on the road out. I just helped him along. It was easy to pick his pockets. He was nearly out of cigarettes, so I switched his last good smoke for one of my special ones. A new reporter would be a link to the knockoff cigarettes where I'd hidden the other fireworks. Thought it might even throw off suspicion. So you could call my granda a field test. A field test? Slater spluttered. Yeah. I hated him, incidentally. Nothing but horrible memories. Violent. Nasty. A bully. But the problem isn't just him. It's our whole generation. I've got it wrong. Messed everything up. And I've got the cheek to get wide about it. They hid it in a plate, not us. Now they're blowing smoke in our faces. Can't get a job, can't get a mortgage because of the world they made and they call you lazy. You know what else I hate? Smoking. I hate that more than anything. Disgusting, filthy habit. Makes utterly no sense on any intellectual level, ignoring the addiction angle. But the social side of it, man. It's like putting your head in a lion's mouth and taking a selfie. You want a perfect example of how wrong we're going as a species? That's it. In 100 years we'll be on the same footing as lead paint or asbestos. We'll wonder why we ever started, why anyone thought it was a good idea, even more than burning fossil fuels. At least travel is a point. You can understand it. You got to go places. But smoking? Where do you start? You could have started a campaign. You could have formed a support group, a prayer meeting, anything. Loman's voice grated under the stress of holding his temper. Anything but that. Wish I'd actually seen it, McLendon crooned, eyes filling with tears. That's my one regret, no seeing it go off. You can quote these words back at me if you like. Too bad he didn't have any time to think about it. But everyone else's time to think about it. From now on, any time they stick a cigarette in their mouth. Slater sighed. Can I huckle him, Gaffer? I'm getting tired of this patter. No need, Loman said. McLendon pointed at them. Think about it, though. Is there anything that tells you more about the state of the world than the tobacco industry? We can't even grow the stuff here. We grow it somewhere else. Exploit another country's natural resources and labour. Then once this stuff makes it here, it kills poor people. I mean, I'm right about that. You have to admit. You're totally wrong, Loman said. You're totally wrong. Just another sad case with a chip on his shoulder who thinks killing innocent people will dislodge it. You haven't even hurt the industry you're targeting. Just watch the share prices hit record levels within about 5 minutes of us announcing we've caught you. They'll remember me. They'll know what I stood for. They'll remember nothing. We get your files. We access your burner accounts. We blocked everything. We've stopped your scheduled social media accounts. The only detail will be when you go to court. You won't have followers. You won't have supporters. Society changes for the better by consensus, son, not by bombs and bullets. Even if McLendon did have a retort for Lomond, that's when the uniformed officers charged in and ended the exchange. As the high-vis yellow tide engulfed him, McLendon gasped, "Be careful with my bag, folks. There's a few live ones in there." A pensive morning out on the waterfront near the kiosk, for Loman and Slater's 5 minutes of fresh air. The air was thick with a sudden fog, Hammer House of Horror style. Occasionally, figures would appear and disappear, lost souls in liminal transit. Only the muted roar of traffic on the Kingston Bridge, a weird jointed monster striding through the white smoke and disappearing into the near distance, gave these elements a sense of place and scale. I kinda like the mist, Loman mused. So you can hide in it, Slater replied. Maybe. But mostly because you can't see the sheriff court. Slater sighed and sipped at his coffee. Yeah, there is that. It also means I can hide too. Ah, you did a grand job, Malcolm. I wouldn't fret about it. Came across really well. The camera loved you. Slater's forehead creased in irritation, and he sat up suddenly. I told you I wasn't cut out for that stuff. It's all part of the job, Malcolm. Worldwide coverage, watching millions. You've got to be high visibility in big cases. It's a feather in your cap. And you remember to tuck your shirt collar in and do your tie properly. That's all important. How was that, I know, Slater whispered, that it was live. I presume they told you beforehand. They didn't. Or maybe they did. Look, I was busy. I had a dozen things to sort out. And this film crew appears. Lights blink on like it's a UFO coming to abduct you. And I was doing absolutely fine, Gaffer. I was doing fine. Up until I got to the bit about recovering all the plastic explosive and said... Slater couldn't finish. Loman finished for him. We've managed to stub out this menace. Wasn't that what you said? Fine words, Malcolm. Poetic. You might have gotten away with it had you said nothing else until you realised your mistake off the bat. So many others wouldn't. And then you said, and I'm quoting you directly, "Ah, oh, bollocks, can we start this again?" Slater cringed. "It was only a bollocks, Malcolm, that's the main thing," Loman said soothingly. "Just one single bollocks. I mean, that could have been worse on live television. Many, many ways it could have been worse." Slater shook his head, then spluttered laughter. A figure appeared through the mist, startling them. It was D.S. Leonard. "Here, Malcolm," she said, handing him a fresh coffee. "I brought you a new one, just in case you want to start again." Slater shook his head, but accepted the coffee. He turned to Lomond. "Two's on this one, Gaffer." "Go on then, fill my cup, would you?" Lomond sat back and began to struggle with the wrapping on his sandwiches. "Minchin passes on his regards, sir," Leonard said. "He says he's delighted you put cigarettes back into his life, though he's a bit worried." "Worried?" Lomond frowned. "He thinks you've done too much of a good job, sir. Says you've probably saved dozens of people, maybe even hundreds. And even after you palmed off the glory of the latest presser to Slater, everyone knows you were in charge and steered the operation through. Papers took a liking to you too. A few editorials you might want to cut out for your scrapbook. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a wee letter on its way from Buckingham Palace, sir, when the New Year honours come around." "Oh, I'd pay money to see that," Slater hooted. "Any amount of money. Please make it a knighthood. Imagine it. The gaffer attempting to kneel in any context, never mind in front of a monarch. Please make it happen." "Is there a campaign? Can I pitch a fiver into a crowdfunder?" Cheeks burning, Lomond asked. "So what's Minchin worried about? I'll get an OBE or a Blue Peter badge before him." "No, it's something else. Something we're all a bit worried about," Leonard continued in earnest. "Let's talk of you going upstairs. More managerial role, planning, infrastructure, back in uniform. We're worried that you'll be taken off the streets." "It's not true, is it, sir?" There was a moment of silence after this statement. The mist had thickened suddenly, partially obscuring Lomond. Then the inspector laughed. "Move upstairs? No chance of that happening. Rest easy. I've got too many riches to be enjoyed down here." He saluted with his half-full coffee cup, then took a bite of his soggy sandwich.
Two's on That is copyrighted by Pat Black. Music for this podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing for the podcast were done by Kevin Wheeler and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.elleryqueenmysterymagazine.com.